yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Sing the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, first of all, let me apologize for a little misstep last week. We had some problems with the phone, so we didn't get to record the show. Last week, as I had promised, we were going to talk about global financial instability. And that was a follow-up to the preceding week, which addressed the topic of, is the global economy slowing? By the way, you can access the Progressive Radio Network archives to listen to that show, Is the Global Economy Slowing?, which is kind of a prelude to what we're going to talk today, which is the global economy becoming increasingly unstable, especially financially unstable? If you've been following what's happening in the Chinese stock market, that may be a canary in the global financial coal mine here. And we may be on the cusp of another financial crisis. I'm not saying that's imminent. In fact, I had previously thought that we would not have a financial crisis a la 2008-09 for at least another 2-3 years, but we were moving in that direction. However, what's going on in China raises the stakes, and we are on the verge, of course, of a number of crises as the Federal Reserve U.S. Central Bank raises interest rates, which looks very likely now. In emerging markets in general, not just China, but important emerging markets, you know, like Brazil and Russia, the oil-producing markets, commodity-producing markets, other places in Latin America, Australia, and so forth, that are very much linked to the Chinese economy and the demand for commodities, so forth, by the Chinese, which is now dramatically slowing. In other words, we have a problem in China with the stock market, and I'll talk about that more, and other financial markets in China, which are very fragile right now. And at the same time in China, we have a definite slowing of their real economy going on. They say it's 7%, but now, increasingly, other estimates, independent estimates, are that the Chinese economy is probably growing around 5%. Maybe a little less, maybe a little more. That is undoubtedly associated with the stock market in China having its current problems. So we have this this locus, you might say, of the global economy has clearly shifted to China, both financially and in terms of economic growth. In fact, we just got some data today that Europe and German exports, in particular industrial production, is really dropped. Well, Germany and its exports are highly dependent on sales to China, and it's pretty clear now that this is the China situation with the slow growth is spilling over to Europe, particularly the engine of Europe, Germany, which is about 35% of the European Eurozone economy. So this situation in China has very definite contagion effect possibilities that we have to watch very closely, both financial and real, meaning the real economy. At the same time, now we've got this drift towards higher interest rates in the U.S. that look like they are definitely going to accelerate. That will intensify the problems in emerging markets, you know, from Brazil to South Africa to Turkey to, well, Australia is not an emerging market, but very dependent on commodities and commodity sales to China. So the crisis looks like it could very much spill over from China to elsewhere in the global economy, both the real economy and the financial economy. So we want to talk this week, though, about financial instability in the global economy. How real is it? And what are the forms it takes? Where is it in terms of a growing, increasingly fragile the global economy? We want to focus again in that discussion on China, which is the focal point, we might say, for the future evolution of this in financial instability. Okay, so let's begin with trying to identify what do we mean when we say, is the global economy becoming more financially unstable? What do we mean by instability? And what causes instability? Instability financially basically means that you have a great volatility in financial asset prices, stocks, bonds, derivatives, foreign exchange. All these are financial assets. And when you have both to the upside and downside, when you have an escalation in these financial asset prices that go too high, you have financial bubbles. So financial bubbles can be a symptom of growing financial instability. And of course, you have financial instability when these bubbles break and you get a significant contraction of financial asset prices. The contraction, the decline, the drop is too fast and too deep. Okay? Those are indications. The prices are a good indicator of financial instability. Prices for financial assets in general. Now it's interesting, isn't it, that we have these financial bubbles. The most obvious of which has been recently this bubble in China in the stocks. China stocks, both Shanghai, Shenzhen markets over there, in the last year escalated 120% or more in 1 year. Doubled, more than doubled in 1 year. Well, what was behind that? Well, we'll talk about that. But basically, that much and that fast a run-up in stock prices, equity prices, in the Chinese stock markets, clearly a bubble, could not be sustained. In fact, the excess run-up eventually would have to have a excess deflation of financial asset prices, in other words, equities, stocks. Now, when you have a particular market that collapses like that, which it has in China, it's been sort of staved off from its natural further collapse by massive Chinese government intervention, which we'll talk about, but that won't work. That only delays the time when the full correction occurs. The problem is when you have that kind of a bubble collapsing, it spreads to other financial markets as well, as the psychology of investors everywhere is affected by it. It spreads to other markets in China, and because China is so important globally, it will and shows already signs of spreading financial contagion, you might say, to other financial markets globally. So China's real economy slowing has implications for real economies elsewhere. I just mentioned Germany and Europe as just one example. Excuse me. But the financial situation in China also has implications for the global financial system. Okay, excuse me. Okay, so let's move back to discussing what do we mean by financial instability, and then we'll move on back to China again. But what causes financial instability in the first place? I mean, the symptoms are bubbles and then collapse of financial asset prices, right? But what causes the bubbles? What causes the collapse? That's the more fundamental question, isn't it? Well, financial instability and bubbles are the product of excess debt. In other words, the prices rise so far, so fast, because debt, in other words, investors borrow funds to go ahead and buy excess assets with them. right? It's the ability to borrow, which is called leveraging debt, that sends these bubbles to the level that they exist. You know, if it wasn't for the ability to borrow so much money, investors who prefer to use borrowed money rather than their own when they invest in stocks and bonds and so forth, at least professional investors. I'm not talking about the, you know, retail investors, mom and pop, who always lose their shirt in these events. But the professional investors, they borrow money. So where does the borrowed money come from? In other words, where does all this debt build up that has overfueled financial markets? Where does it come from? Well, it comes from excess money creation by central banks. And if you look at the U.S. and Britain and Europe and Japan, they've been pumping trillions of dollars into the global economy since 2008 alone, trillions before that, but especially since 2008. If you do some quick calculations and look at how much have these central banks pumped into the global economy since 2008, you get at least $10 trillion of just money creation, direct money creation, called quantitative easing, you know, where they actually, central banks print the money and use it to buy bonds and assets that the private sector owns, and they pump this money into the economy, into the banks, into the shadow banks, and into what are sometimes called very high net worth investors. There's about 200,000 globally of what are called very and ultra high net worth investors around the world. Sounds like a big number, but 200,000 is really not that significant, who own most of and control most of the investable liquid assets. Shadow banks are their preferred institutions. At least $100 trillion in liquid investable assets are controlled by the shadow banking system and these private investors who are the owners and participants in, you know, the private equity firms, the hedge funds, and so on and so forth, right? Massive amount of liquid investable assets are under their control today. This has been a product, basically, of just the last four decades, by the way, but it's massive right now. And they have all these liquid assets, and they move this money around to this or that financial asset market. You know, they move a lot of it into China, first into the property markets in China, caused a bubble there, into local governments who borrowed heavily from them in order to build infrastructure in China, sometimes just almost Potemkin village-like cities and towns. You know, cause bubbles in those markets. The money then spilled over in China into what's called asset management investments. And then it, as we will see later, was redirected by the Chinese government into the stock market, causing the bubble in the stock market. It's very difficult to stop bubbles. You can redirect the money from one bubble to another if you're a government, but actually stopping it is extremely difficult, as China has discovered. China has been fighting their shadow banks for some time. It's a love-hate relationship. They want them for the excess liquidity to boost their economy so they don't have to have their own central bank print the money themselves, but, you know, it's letting the fox into the hen house, and then you have other problems with speculation and bubbles. So we've had these bubbles in China, and they're moving around, and they just moved most recently in the past year into the stock market, and now that is collapsing, contracting. So we have, you know, financial instability is the product of excess debt, and excess debt is the product of massive liquidity injection, money injection, over the last four decades by central banks into the global system. Massive. I just mentioned quantitative easing, $10 trillion alone. But, you know, what about the 7 years of zero interest rates? Banks can go to central banks like the Federal Reserve, Bank of England, whatever, and they borrow money well, actually, it's free money. You know, it's like 0.1% as a result of policies of central banks. Banks can borrow money at 0.1%. Oh, okay, so they borrow that money. What do they do with it? I'm talking about private banks now. Well, they, of course, invest it. Banks don't like to leave money idle, so they invest it. Well, where do they invest it? Well, it's not in your mom-and-pop businesses, that's for sure, because there's so much more profitability of loaning it to shadow banks, who then speculate in derivatives and financial assets and various kinds, stock markets, equity markets, bond markets, globally. Or the banks loan this free money to multinational corporations who then take it and have been investing abroad in emerging markets with it. And it was creating infrastructure and commodities productions, resource productions, and so forth, investments in emerging markets. So the money has flowed out of the advanced economies like the U.S. and the U.K. and others. Since all this money creation acceleration has occurred since 2008-09. It's important to know that these central banks have been pumping money into the economy for decades now, particularly since the 1970s, when what was called the Bretton Woods dollar gold standard collapsed in 1973, and it was left up to the central banks to stabilize global currencies. And that's when we began this problem of central bank injection of liquidity time and time and time again, and they don't take much out of the economy, and it just keeps building out there. And all that excess liquidity, thus, as I said, you get shadow banks forming and liquid markets, financial markets forming and financial securities innovations being created, and the rise of this global finance capital elite of 200,000 getting massively rich and holding all these assets, and they got to do something with it. So, you know, they move the money around to these various financial markets around the world now, and they speculate, and they make even more money. But it causes bubbles. But the root cause of all this is all this excess liquidity creation that has been going on for decades and is accelerating since 2008. QE, quantitative easing, printing of money by central banks, is just a part of that. You've got this other part of very, very low interest rates by central banks. Banks come and borrow for virtually nothing, and then they loan it to other shadow banks and other investors and big multinational corporations, and we get what I just described. That money created, that free money created by the central banks does not get into or is not getting into the real economy, into real investment. That's a big problem, right? It's being directed out of the real economy and into financial asset investment and speculation. That's a big characteristic of 21st century global capitalism today, and why we have these financial imbalances and financial bubbles and crises occurring more frequently and more seriously. The money is flowing, created, all that liquidity by central banks is flowing into financial assets. And that's why if you look at the figures, real investment, investment in real things, in other words, in buildings and structures and equipment and inventories and so forth, that create real jobs, that give income to real people, that is slowing. Real investment is slowing globally, has been for a number of years. Now that's intensifying, that slowdown. And therefore, we have a problem with real job creation. You know, the job creation we get is mostly part-time, temporary, low-paid service jobs. It's not your jobs that are associated with producing real things, you know, construction and manufacturing and so on and so forth. That's less and less what's going on. So the quality of jobs is less, is much lower. Quality in terms of income and wages associated with jobs. You know, they just released the job numbers today for the U.S., and, you know, the last 3 months there were about 200,000 jobs being created. But the wages are falling. Why is that? I mean, gee, in the past, you know, job creation led to wage increases because you had more jobs. and people were able to get wage increases because the supply of labor was less and so forth. But that's not happening anymore, you see. You're creating these low-quality jobs that don't raise wages. And if you don't raise wages, then you're not going to stimulate consumption. And if you're not going to stimulate consumption and demand for products, then businesses aren't going to invest and expand. Ah, real investment declines. On top of that, we see this collapse of oil and commodities globally, and energy companies and commodity-producing in emerging markets and so forth are contracting their real investment rapidly. And, of course, transport slows down as a result. And transport companies invest less. And you have this sort of a chain effect throughout the economy, so that real investment declines, therefore real income declines, and consumption declines, or doesn't really grow. It grows to the extent that maybe the system feeds more debt into consumers so they can maintain their standard of living. Consumption growth based on real income growth, which is the healthy form, is not growing. So we have this problem of real asset investment and real jobs and real income and consumption and so forth on one side of the global economy. And that's why if you look globally, as we talked about 2 weeks ago, the real economy is slowing. Conversely, though, the asset financial economy is growing. And we got this big spread, this big dichotomy between financial investment and bubbles and so forth, and all the money flowing there, and on the other hand, real investment slowing down, less real job creation, incomes, and so forth. Okay, so that's the characteristic of 21st century global capitalist economy, a fundamental characteristic, right? So financial instability is really debt. Debt on the financial side, although falling standard of living means that you get more debt on the real side as well in households and businesses that aren't involved in financial, particularly small and medium businesses. They have to increase their debt load as well to keep going because, you know, the goods and services they sell aren't in as great a demand because people don't have enough money to buy them. So we have on the business side, we have at the small end, the real end, we have debt rising. And on the household side, we have debt rising as well. But debt for speculation, financial asset, is different. It's borrowing money to make more money. In other words, if I'm a speculator, one of these 200,000 financial capitalist elites around the world, you know, I'm going to borrow $9 for every dollar I put in if I'm going to go and buy currencies, right? If I expect Swiss francs to rise, I'm going to go borrow from hedge funds or from some other shadow bank, whatever, and use somebody else's money. So, you know, debt rises on the financial side as well. And that's another characteristic of the financialization of the global economy. Now, debt rising isn't a problem as long as your income is rising as well, right? As long as you know, prices for your financial assets or goods, whatever, are rising, you can carry that extra debt. But when prices stop rising, the debt doesn't go away, but your income declines. You see, your income flow necessary to pay the principal and interest on the previously accumulated debt declines. So you get this gap between the ability to pay for your debt and the rising debt itself, and what that leads to is inability to make your payments on your debt. Oh, when the market and other investors see a company or a sector unable to make payments on their debt, they say, let's dump their stock, right? Or let's get rid of their bonds that we bought because they may not be able to pay it back. So you get a collapse in the prices of the equities, in other words, the stocks, and a rising cost of interest rates for those companies. A good example is what's happening in the shale gas sector in the United States. A lot of these small, medium companies jumped into the shale drilling revolution here in the last several years and made a lot of money, but had to borrow a lot of money at relatively high rates. And or issue bonds in which they had to pay interest rates that were quite high, right? We call these junk bonds. So a lot of the shale gas production is based on junk bond debt, a high rate of debt. Now, what's happening globally, the oil glut and Saudi Arabia and OPEC countries driving down the price of oil to try to drive these competitors out of business in the shale sector in the U.S., a big battle going on between them, and oil prices are falling. You know, they're down below $50 again. They're going to go lower, and these companies can't make their payments on their previous high debt, so they default. You know, the default rates are going to rise in the shale patch here, and when that happens, you know, the stocks of these companies are going to collapse and so forth. And the question is, if that happens, will it spread to other sectors? Same thing we can say about China. If the China stock market continues to collapse, what will be the contagion on other markets? We already know that the U.S. Markets, particularly, you know, the Dow Jones and the NASDAQ, are, you know, for months now, have gone nowhere. They're sort of just churning at the top. They can't go any higher. And investors there are just looking for signals, I believe, globally that say, okay, this stock boom is all over. We made trillions of dollars. Or this junk bond boom is over. We made trillions of dollars. Time to sell off and move on. Hold our money, our cash, until things get better again, right? We're very close to that in the U.S. stock markets, very close to that. And if this situation in China gets worse, we could see a major correction in the U.S. stock prices. And, of course, the Fed raising interest rates may precipitate that as well. So we're just going to have to watch and see what happens. And, of course, if China and U.S. stocks collapse in tandem here, you can bet the rest of the world's going to follow suit, right? Europe itself is pretty fragile, its banking system, its markets, and so forth. So is Japan. Japan has slipped back into its fifth recession here since 2008. Japan's been a basket case for decades, in and out of recession, going nowhere. And in Europe, of course, we've had pretty much stagnation with a couple of recessions. And to the extent that we've had any growth in Europe, it's been very, very minimal. And we have this financial situation with the Greek debt that's still festering over there. And emerging markets everywhere and around the world are slipping into recession, and their stock and bond markets are collapsing and so forth. So the picture in terms of financial instability is not very pleasant. It's not very positive. It's not bullish, as they say. It hasn't tripped over and collapsed yet, but it's sort of struggling at a peak and pretty much, you know, on the cusp, I would say. They can put this off for, you know, some more months. China can do even more than what it's doing to try to boost its stock market. Chinese government, I'm talking about, but in the long run, they, you know, there's no way they can really prevent this thing from occurring in China. It's just a matter of time. So when the Chinese stock market really contracts once again, what will be the contagion effect on U.S. stocks, U.S. bonds? What will be the contagion effects within China on other markets within China and on emerging markets? You know, they're all already extremely fragile. The collapse of the slowing, dramatic slowing of economic growth in China, and the collapse of their stock market there coincides with the U.S. raising its interest rates. That's a double whammy impact on emerging markets like Brazil and others. Double whammy because what it means is their growth is going to slow in these emerging markets, which it is. Brazil and a number of others are already in recession. But the second hit is going to be when U.S. interest rates start to rise. And then what happens is capital flows out of Brazil and emerging markets even faster than it has been. And you have a much bigger crisis financially and in the real economy in those countries, major emerging markets. Time. So we have this very unstable situation in terms of real growth and financial in China. We have a similar parallel unstable situation in other major emerging markets around the world. And we have a U.S. economy that, contrary to what they say, is in a stop-go scenario. In other words, low growth when there is any growth and then periodic stagnation. In other words, for a quarter, a relapse or so, we're down to zero or less GDP growth. That's been four times that's happened. So the U.S. Economy is not all that robust as they say it is. And, of course, Europe has been stagnant for some time. The real picture is not strong for the global economy, and there's growing concerns that the global economy is getting more fragile, the real economy. Talking about GDP production, et cetera. But the financial side of this is perhaps even more fragile, as we see in these churning stock markets and in China and emerging markets, stock and bond markets in Europe, et cetera. Okay. So, again, just to summarize, what's important in terms of financial stability indicators is too much debt and not enough income to pay for the debt when prices and incomes begin to turn south. And those are the main determinants of financial instability. And what provokes it is investors as a group globally, this 200,000 finance capital elite, having a big shift in their psychology and expectations of where the global economy is going. And when that happens, they pull all their money out of these markets. Financial asset deflation accelerates, and then we have a financial crisis. Usually it starts in one or more areas and spreads to others. It doesn't occur all at once. And the best candidate for the start of this process is probably in China right now. Okay, I want to come back. We're going to take a brief break here. I'm going to come back, and I want to talk more about what are the danger points in these financial markets globally that are the most likely candidates for a crisis event. And then I want to talk more about China. And why China is the locus of financial instability and global economic instability today. Okay, this is Alternative Visions. This is Jack Rasmus. And I will be back after a little break here, announcement, and we'll jump into these other topics. Global economy. Okay, returning again, let's pick up where we left off here. We're talking about how unstable and fragile is the global financial system. Let me just identify some of the more unstable financial markets here globally that need to be watched in the next few months here. One, of course, is the China stock market. This is the real danger point right now in China. And the possibility of contagion within China to the other markets, financial markets in China as well. So China stocks, both the Shanghai and the Shenzhen stock markets. Secondly, I would say U.S. tech stocks are very much unstable, and we should watch what happens there. It, of course, will be linked psychologically by investors to what happens in China stocks. What are called bond exchange traded funds, or ETFs, bond ETFs. I don't want to get into too much of a financial definition and explanation, but ETFs are where average investors and speculators can buy a bond that is made up of different stocks or made up of different bonds or whatever. This is a form of what's called securitization, where you take a financial security and you bundle a bunch of financial securities together. You call it a bond, and then you mark up the bond and sell the bond. This is what happened with subprime market housing bonds up to 2008. You know, those market bonds, subprime mortgages and mortgage bonds were combined with other assets like CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, asset-backed securities, whatever, and securitized. In other words, make a security out of security, we mark it up and sell it, and then we take that security and we get other securities, we put them all together in another financial salad bowl, and we mark that up and sell it. That's securitization, and of course that links all these assets, and when one collapses, they all collapse, right? Well, bond ETFs, exchange-traded funds, based upon stocks or other bonds, junk bonds and so forth, bond ETF funds sold by mutual funds, a kind of a shadow bank, is very much a locus as well of potential problem, financial fragility. Also, we have this growing problem of there's just not enough liquidity in the bond market should a big sell-off occur. A lot of commercial banks have pulled out of selling bonds, and we have shadow banks now taking over, and there's not enough liquidity. In other words, if people start selling these bonds, investors start selling these bonds, there won't be enough buyers and middlemen and so forth to buy them, therefore, prices will fall even faster. Bond prices will fall even faster. So that's a problem. Bond liquidity in general. Bond ETFs, exchange-traded funds, and bond liquidity. Another potential crisis center is the U.S. repurchase market, repo market as it's called. And this is where banks and financial institutions use the collateral of their existing assets to borrow short-term funds. But if the collateral values of those existing assets collapse, then they can't borrow funds. And that's going to be a problem. Junk bonds are what's called U.S. high-yield bonds. In other words, companies issue bonds, raise money by issuing bonds, but pay very high interest for them because the company is not all that financially stable. The U.S. shale sector, a lot of companies have raised money for drilling through junk bonds, and a lot of the U.S. junk bond market is comprised of shale companies, and we know those companies, a lot of them are going to go under in default. And the question is, will that default spill over to the rest of the high-yield junk bond market? Or will it be contained? We don't know. But that's a instability point as well. A big instability point is global oil and commodities, which are collapsing in price. We are like the lowest commodity prices in more than a decade. Well, 13, 14 years, I think, maybe 19 years. Commodities price deflation is a serious problem. Of course, that's related to the slowdown in China's economy and the slow growth in the U.S. and in Europe, and no growth in Japan. So there's a commodities glut. You know, by commodities, I mean different kinds of metals, copper, iron, et cetera. Oil, of course, is a commodity, food commodities, et cetera. So commodities price collapse is very serious because commodities are also a financial security, as is oil. It's a physical good. These are physical goods, but there's futures trading on these. So when these prices collapse, it sends a psychological message elsewhere that maybe the global economy is entering a very bearish, slow growth phase. We better pull our investments out, right? Since emerging markets, stock and bond markets are very much influenced by commodities and what's happening with commodities, those stock markets and those bond markets contract significantly as well when you have commodity price deflation, which is going on. You can see it particularly with oil, with the oil collapse. Crude oil prices have collapsed from $120 a barrel to approaching $40 now. Part of that is natural, and part of that is this big global fight between capitalists, particularly the OPEC, Saudi and their friends, Middle East friends there, and versus the shale oil, shale gas and shale oil startups here in North America and elsewhere. The Saudis want to drive these companies out of business, so that they can then therefore raise their prices and charge, rentier kind of inflation prices and continue their extreme profits they've made for decades. Right, so there's a battle between the capitalists here going on, and oil prices have collapsed. And you see the effect of that on recessions in countries, around the world that are very dependent on oil exports, like Russia and Venezuela, Nigeria, Indonesia, and so forth, right? These are other oil-exporting countries here. And the collapse of global oil prices is having a big effect on their economies and on their financial markets. So watch what's happening with commodities, oil, and other industrial commodities in particular, and should that deflation continue to occur and worsen, it could very well spill over into equity and bond markets. That's one of the big danger points in the global financial economy today, along with, I would say, junk bonds and bond ETFs, and China's stock market. But we also have Eurozone, the Eurozone banks, and what's happening in Greece and elsewhere is a problem for the Eurozone. The Eurozone simply cannot get their banks to lend to the real economy. The Eurozone Central Bank has pumped in, starting to pump in over $1 trillion of QE, hopefully some of it, with the hope that some of it will trickle down into the real economy, but it doesn't seem to be happening. QE tends to get misdirected into financial asset markets, stock and other markets. But that doesn't seem to be happening that much in Europe. The stock markets are not escalating the way they did in the U.S. and U.K. with QE, or temporarily in Japan with QE, which has since, dissipated. And that's because of the instability in the banking system and this big issue of debt here in the periphery of Europe, which hasn't gone away. The Greece situation is, Greek debt situation negotiations is just a symptom of a bigger problem in Europe in its financial system, right? We're going to see more instability over there, I believe. Okay, so Eurozone banks, currency wars. Currency, foreign exchange is a financial asset. This is a globally every day $5-6 trillion, I believe, is bought and sold of exchange, foreign exchange currencies. Right, it's hundreds of trillions of dollars every year. Foreign exchange, bought and sold, a lot of it by governments, but also increasingly by individual financial investors, particularly shadow banks and our favorite 200,000, right? Even retail, in other words, small folks are buying securities and losing their shirt. That's a financial market, and we're getting a lot of volatility in currencies right now, which is an indication of financial problems globally. The dollar and the British pound are going to rise, and the euro and the yen are going to fall, as they have been, and we get these big swings. And the big question is, will China resort to reducing its currency, the yuan or renminbi? And what impact will that have on global currencies? We don't know. Of course, if you look at emerging markets, their currencies are collapsing. The oil commodity producing countries, you know, Venezuela, Russia, Nigeria, even Canada, Mexico, their currencies are falling. The problem with falling currencies is no one wants to invest in those countries where it looks like the currencies over a longer term are going to continue to contract, right? Why invest in Mexico if the peso is going to fall? I'm a foreign investor, right? Why do I want to invest in Mexico if as soon as I convert my currency to Mexican pesos, those pesos are going to collapse? I'm not going to do that. So what you get is with collapsing currencies in emerging markets, you not only do not get investment flowing into those countries, but the investment that was already in those countries, a lot of it by Western bankers and investors, starts flowing out of those countries. In other words, they start selling those assets, converting it back to their own home currencies, and the money flows out. Well, if the money flows out of those countries, you're going to have less in those countries for investment, and that means the stock markets and bond markets are going to go south in those countries as well. And what happens is these emerging market countries then try to raise their domestic interest rates to attract foreign capital and investors and prevent the same from leaving. But that raising of their domestic interest rates has the effect of slowing their domestic economies as well. So currency wars are an indicator of growing financial instability, and the currency wars are being lost definitely by the emerging markets. They're the ones being hit most severely by it, right? Rising dollar has a negative impact on the U.S. Economy as well. It's already dramatically slowing U.S. exports and raising imports, which means a negative contribution by exports to U.S. GDP. And that's going to get much worse, especially as the Fed raises short-term rates. Long-term interest rates in the U.S. have been rising, and that's been having an effect already on U.S. Exports and therefore GDP. So once we see the Fed raising interest rates further, that's going to have a further destabilizing effect on the U.S. economy, and we don't know to what extent it's going to have a significant negative impact on U.S. stocks that, as I said, are kind of churning at the top, trying to continue, but going nowhere, and raising interest rates just may be the precipitating effect that causes U.S. stocks to take a big contraction, 10% or more. That would be a major contraction. Could be even more. We'll see. You know, during the 2008 crisis, U.S. stocks dropped 65%. Right? That's significant. And of course, we're not talking about the imminence of something like that in the U.S. right now, but certainly a major correction could occur. Right? Another problem we're going to see is, I believe, high-end residential real estate prices are going to escalate, but that will be selective places geographically. Money is starting to flow out of China as big investors take their money out of stocks in China at the first opportunity when China government sort of stabilizes the stock situation there. Every time we get a little stabilization, the money flows out. And then, of course, the stocks drop a little bit more. And we're going to see a series of those events in China over the next 6 months. Where does that money go? Well, it goes into high-end property. The wealthy folks who made money in stocks and other markets over in China, both Chinese and non-Chinese wealthy folks, move their money out, and they will move it into properties in the West, you know, to some extent in Australia, but in Singapore maybe, but there's not much opportunity there to buy high-end residential properties. So it flows to the U.S. You know, it'll flow to the West Coast. It'll flow to Vancouver, San Francisco, Seattle, places like that, East Coast preferred high-end residential markets, flows to London, other places, select places where the rich congregate in Europe, and it'll drive up residential prices significantly. You get a property boom bubble once again as this money flows back. Okay, so those are just some of the pressure points in the global financial system here, right, that we need to watch that are becoming unstable. China stocks at the top of this particular list, bond ETFs, junk bonds, global oil commodities futures, emerging market equity and bond markets, Eurozone banks, currency wars, high-end property, and, more esoteric later on, bond liquidity, U.S. repurchase markets, and so forth. So definitely the trend is towards more financial instability along those lines that need to be watched. Okay, so let's talk in what remains about China in the stock market there. To understand why this stock market a bubble occurred, more than 100% in 1 year, you got to understand that China government's strategy for economic growth that it launched in 2009-10, which was massive fiscal spending and monetary injection, very much like the rest of the world. Their fiscal stimulus package was about 15% of their GDP in 2009. The U.S. was less than 5%. They got a rapid recovery, China did. That rapid recovery, more than 10% GDP annually for several years, pulled up the rest of the emerging markets who provide commodities and intermediate goods sales to China. So emerging markets boomed, China boomed because it had a different policy. A lot of the money of the U.S. Stimulus, QE and so forth, as I said before, flowed out of the U.S. into these fast-growth China emerging markets. And that's why we did not have a strong growth in the U.S. initially after 2009. A lot of this excess money, though, in China and from the world into China produced bubbles in their property markets to begin with, and in local government markets, because local governments they didn't have to borrow from China government banks. They could borrow from hedge funds. They could borrow from global financial inflows came into this local government, and they overbuilt a lot of these industrial commercial construction projects. Residential property construction got overbuilt, and bubbles occurred, of course. And it was a big problem. China attempted, starting a couple years ago, to tame these shadow banks and foreign capital with limited success. And then last year, China decided they were going to, if they couldn't stop the money and the shadow banking and the speculation, they were going to divert it to the stock markets. The idea was China is trying to shift from an over-reliance on government direct investment, which is 45% of the economy, and export sales, to internal investment, private investment, and internal consumption. It was more of a Western kind of a model and picture. Well, the whole idea was, let's divert this all this capital that's causing bubbles in local government structure, infrastructure, and property, residential property, let's divert that into the stock market. And the rising stock market, it was thought, would cause more private investment, take up the slack from government investment reliance, and it would also stimulate incomes, high-end households, that would stimulate consumption. You see, they want to shift to long-term reforms, they call it, to more private investment and more private consumption. Okay, well, the government did a number of things to stimulate this and stimulate the stock market purposely. And they passed rules inviting more foreign capital. They passed rules allowing investors to borrow more money on margin, as they call it, margin buying, and opened up the stock market to this big speculative bubble since last November. and their stock market took off, and the prices rose to unsustainable heights because you had so much borrowing, margin borrowing, in order to carry out all this investment purchase in financial assets in stocks in the markets. Right, so they created a bubble. Yes, they diverted the money and the money capital from the other bubbles and from foreign, into those housing and construction bubbles. They diverted it to the stock market, but they lost control of it. And what you got was this massive escalation. When financial asset prices go that high that fast, there's no way they can be sustained without a major correction. That major correction began in June of this year, June 12th, a big collapse in China stock prices, brought the Chinese government in to try to stop the collapse through a whole number of measures which are still in progress. Estimates just come out is that, $300 billion, roughly, of Chinese government intervention to prop up the stock market. Well, that's going to cause more problems than solutions. They should have let this market correct significantly rather than try to stop a correction that has to occur because it was in bubble territory. But the Chinese government is trying to prevent that. Well, you can't prevent that. You can slow it, maybe, and delay it, postpone the collapse, have it occur in stages instead of all at once, which is, there's some positive to that kind of a policy, and that appears to what's being happening, but you can't stop the collapse. It's over. Psychological expectations set in, and investors, and once they decide that this market is over, they're going to get their money out of there and move it somewhere else. Now, you can stop them from taking it out, as China has, by new rules and regulations, slow down the sales, and at the same time, China has attempted to stimulate more purchases of stock to slow it down. In other words, since June, China's policy has been to slow the sales of stocks and increase the purchase of stocks through a whole number of measures here that I'm not going to get into, but include forcing government agencies and brokers and so forth to buy more and more stocks, preventing anybody that owns 5% or more of a stock of a company from doing any selling, suspending sales of stocks. At one point, 1,500 corporations in China could not sell their stock, canceling initial public offerings, limiting margin lending, which had caused a lot of the bubble there, getting private brokerages to buy more stock, forcing government enterprises to buy more stock, and banning of short selling, as they say, of stock by speculators, and pumping more money into the stock market through state investment funds. All these things have been the measures China has introduced since June, and it looked like they had stabilized it, but then all of a sudden, the stock market's dropped another 8.5% a few weeks ago. That brought even more efforts in by the government to stabilize it, which appears they have temporarily. But this whole event is not over. This is going to continue. And government intervention, more and more money, and stocks falling just the same regardless. So what we have here is this very, very unstable picture of financial markets, particularly stock markets in China. And the question is it going to spill over to the U.S. markets and other emerging markets in Europe and so forth? Are we on the verge of perhaps a new threshold moving towards more and more global financial instability? We will see. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.